Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we are eating leftovers. But it will be fresh, delicious radio nonetheless as we revisit three of our favorite segments this year about food. We'll make tortellini from scratch with Chef Joe Gatto, who swears it's the perfect pasta vehicle for leftover meat and vegetables. Three WBUR reporters share their adventures trying to eat sustainably three different ways. And what's more sustainable than eating leftovers, by the way? But first, last March, Chef J. Kenji Lopez-Alt introduced us to a wok, and it turns out it's great for cooking leftovers and pretty much everything else. For that matter, Kenji was studying biology at MIT in the 90s when he bought his first wok, which he still uses today. Bought it at a Target in Somerville. He was learning to cook at the time, first at Fire and Ice, and then as chef for his MIT fraternity. He would go on to cook in renowned kitchens in Greater Boston, write a food column for Serious Eats, and author a children's book called Every Night is Pizza Night. When we spoke with him, Kenji's latest book, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques, which needs little explanation unless you don't know what a wok is.
Well, I hope everybody's familiar with what a wok is. It's, it's a cooking vessel that originated in China, but of course spread to the rest of East Asia. What makes it unique is its shape. It has a very wide, round shape that allows you to toss things very effectively. So, when people think of woks, they most commonly think of stir fries. And of course, stir fries are a great way to use it. It's the way that I primarily use mine, mainly because when I'm cooking very frequently, speed is my goal. There are some days when I want to spend, all day on Sunday braising some short ribs, but most of the time I'm trying to get dinner on the table for my friends or my family. And a wok is a great way to do that. A stir fry is a great way to do that. But the reason I especially love my wok and why it has such a permanent place on my stovetop is that it's extremely versatile. So it's not just good for stir fries. You can also, I think it's the best tool for deep frying in because you can sort of maneuver foods around in it much more easily than you can in a straight-sided sort of Western style Dutch oven or pot. It's great for making stock. It's great for steaming. You can stack bamboo steamers on top of it and steam, fish and vegetables all at the same time. And I know this sounds like an infomercial, which is ironic because the late night infomercials in the 80s were where I first really started learning about woks. But everything they said in those commercials is true. It's extremely versatile, deep frying, pan frying, making noodles, making rice, steaming in them, yeah. Smoking in them, all these things you can do in this one inexpensive vessel.
So I have this confession to make, right? I take the book and I'm going to do some cooking with it, which I did. I had to buy a wok, season the wok, the whole nine yards.
Good.
But this book is 500 pages on woking. If that's a word, a little overwhelming, pages and pages about how to slice the chicken right. And when I saw the word blowtorch, I almost dropped the book. So how do you find that balance of going deep, which you're known for in the science of this and the technique of this, but also attract neophytes like me to doing this kind of cooking?
Well, so, this book, much more than my first book, is really aimed at a much more sort of practical approach. So you can, if you want, just jump right into the recipes. But you know what? I always have this feeling that, at least for me and the way I cook, I like having, I like knowing the technique and understanding the science. The analogy that I use in the book is that just following a recipe is like following turn-by-turn directions on your phone. So I can say to my phone, take me to the post office and stare down at my phone and just start walking and I'll get to the post office, right? But I won't really get a feel for the neighborhood or what's around me. I won't be able to choose my own route to get there or choose a new location to get to. I'm sort of stuck doing this one thing. Whereas once you understand technique and the science behind the cooking, that's sort of like being given a map where you can go to the post office if you want, and you can get sort of a suggested route there, but you can also choose to go somewhere else, and you can choose to get there your own way. And it also makes you much more adaptable through changing conditions. If you don't have the exact right ingredients, or you don't have the exact same tools, that's sort of the reason why I like to give a lot of technique and science in my cookbooks, because for a certain type of cook, I think it's an empowering thing to have that knowledge.
In your mind, what is the coolest bit of science behind cooking with a wok?
The coolest bit of science. I found this really fascinating study that a professor of fluid dynamics, I believe at the University of Georgia, I can't remember, it's in the book, but a professor of fluid dynamics did on the motion of stir frying, where he shot slow motion video of Chinese chefs doing stir fries, and then analyzed the way the wok moves and the way it affects the food inside it. And he was able to narrow it down to these sort of four basic motions, which are difficult to explain over the radio, but there's photographs in the book that show what the four motions are. And what was really interesting to me was that from chef to chef, almost all of them rocked the wok at the same frequency, which is about three times a second is how often they were tossing the food inside it. And I found that really interesting.
So I want to talk some of the recipes in the book. To do that, I want to start with why you are part Japanese. This is a Chinese cooking tradition. Mm-hmm. You were raised in New York, but you were born in Cambridge, came back here for school at MIT. Mm-hmm. How did your Boston roots, the local connection, bring you to the wok and some of the recipes you really cherish in this book?
Well, in a number of ways, my parents lived in Cambridge, and I don't know if you're aware, but Cambridge was sort of the epicenter of Sichuan cuisine in the West, in the U.S. It's where Joyce Chen first introduced a lot of the Sichuan classics that are now known across the country. I grew up in a Japanese American household. My father, who is from Western Pennsylvania, was obsessed with Chinese food growing up, and still is. And so we would spend a lot of time going around Chinatown in New York and Chinatown in Boston, as well as hitting all the suburbs in Boston where you can find a lot of great Sichuan food. So I was exposed a lot to both the New York Chinese style, which is more Southern Chinese, Cantonese, and Chinese American, as well as the more Northern Chinese styles that you see in Boston. Of course, these days there's Sichuan restaurants in New York as well, but early on it was much more in Boston that you'd see the Sichuan stuff. My parents also had a copy of the Joyce Chen cookbook. If you're unfamiliar with Joyce Chen, she was the first woman of color to have a cooking show on TV. She is the creator of a lot of things you're probably familiar with. She's the creator of numbered menus at Chinese restaurants that help people who don't speak the language or understand the names of the dishes order more easily. She created polypropylene cutting boards. She created, she owns the patent for flat bottom woks, which is was the original patent owner for flat bottom woks, which is what I recommend people cook with now on Western ranges. Created the first line of bottled stir fry sauces, a number [S2] Wow. [S1] Of these amazing things that she did. She also had a cookbook that came out in the 60s that my parents, I grew up with my parents cooking from that book. And so I didn't really know it at the time, but a lot of the dishes that my dad and my mom cooked at home came from this Joyce Chen cookbook. And it was years later that I sort of made that connection and realized, oh, like this is the book where all those things that I knew came from.
Okay, so Cambridge can claim her, right? And there's this influence there. You said a minute ago, there are a number of recipes that, would sort of come more from Boston influences. Pick one. What's one recipe that you would sort of tie on a map back to your Boston experience or your parents' Boston experience? What's one in the book?
Well, like hot and sour soup, which is on Chinese menus across the country now. Hot and sour soup was introduced first in Boston. Mushu pork was introduced in Boston. Pan-fried dumplings, which Joyce Chen, she was the one who came up with the term picking ravioli, which is what it's still called in the Boston area. And the Boston area is really the only place in the country where they still call pan-fried dumplings picking ravioli. Those are the dishes. There's a number of other ones as well. Shrimp and lobster sauce. That's a sort of simultaneous arose in New England and Toronto area. But that was something that's not really familiar, in the bigger Chinatowns in like New York or San Francisco, for example.
Different cooking surfaces. How does one make a wok, whether it's gas or electric or some other form, maybe flame? Outdoors. I know in the book you've done some cooking outdoors. Kenji, talk about that.
Yeah. So, there's this misconception, I think, particularly in the West, and it's one that I held for a long time, that you need a really powerful gas burner to cook with a wok. And I think this idea comes from the fact that most of my exposure and a lot of people's exposure in the West to Chinese cuisine in particular comes from restaurants. In particular, it comes from Southern Chinese, Cantonese style restaurants, where there are a number of dishes that require this really high flame to develop a flavor called wok hei, the kind of smoky flavor that certain dishes get. I think, once you actually start to sit down and think about it and become more familiar with other regional Chinese cuisines, other East Asian cuisines, and also with, Chinese, Japanese, Thai home cooking, you realize quickly that, that super high gas burner is only really necessary for a certain very small percentage of dishes. So I think in my book, there's maybe, 5% of the recipes in there that benefit from having a really powerful gas burner. And there are sort of workarounds that you can use for it. You mentioned the torch earlier. So using a kitchen torch is one way you can sort of bring that flavor to the wok. Most of the recipes in the book and most home cooking you can do very easily with a flat bottom wok on an electric or an induction cooktop. The only difficult parts are the initial seasoning of the wok. So when you get a brand new carbon steel wok, which is what I recommend, you have to first scrub off the manufacturer coating that's on there to keep it, prevent it from rusting during shipping and storage. And then you need to heat the whole surface of the wok until it kind of turns black, right? And it's very easy to do on a gas burner because you just turn on the flame and kind of rotate it around until it turns black. On an electric burner or an induction burner, you can get the bottom, but it's hard to get the sides. There's two ways I recommend doing it. You can either remove any parts of it that are not heat safe. So if it has a wooden handle or a polypropylene handle, something like that, you can unscrew it and then season it in the oven the same way you would a cast iron skillet. Or you can get a kitchen torch just take the flame directly to the metal surface and sort of heat it up all over until it turns black. And once it's been properly seasoned, the vast majority of recipes you're going to be able to do just fine on electric or induction. In fact, when I'm on, I'm doing a bunch of these sort of live tour events, and most venues don't allow gas fires indoors. So I have a portable induction cooktop that I've been doing demonstrations on with a wok, and it works just fine.
One of the recipes I made this weekend was Pad See Ew, and the noodles, which I needed to boil, they were dry noodles. You said use the wok for that, which I was also very surprised about. So, these starches, these carbs, and the wok working well for them, it's a little surprising.
there's no reason to pull out a separate pan when you've already got a big thing that can boil water, which is all you really need for cooking noodles or pasta or rice. There's a whole chapter on cooking rice in the wok as well.
Yeah. All right. So we've got another question. This is from at J. Diablet. Ask Kenji what to do about soybean allergies, especially soy sauce. And in your section on essential ingredients, Kenji, dark soy sauce, you've got listed as essential. So what about that?
That's a very tough one. And actually one I'm contending with right now, because we have a 6-month-old at home who has a soy protein allergy, or not allergy, but he's he can't eat, it leads to trouble downstream when he has soy protein, even if it's in milk. So my wife has been avoiding soy protein. It's really difficult to do a lot of these recipes. I think it does end up cutting out, if you have a soy protein allergy, it does end up cutting out, about a good 70% of the recipes or so. So mainly, what I've been focusing on in doing in the wok is cooking things more. So a lot more of the Southeast Asian stuff, which frequently has fish sauce instead of soy sauce in it. There are some Chinese sauces that don't contain soy. So for example, oyster sauce has no soy in it. So any of the dishes that rely on oyster sauce for flavor, you can cook those, as well as, there are some Japanese dishes in the book that use, they'll use a combination of dashi, which is a fish stock dashi, sake, and soy sauce. And in those, I often swap out soy sauce for a little bit of oyster sauce instead.
Can you think of one recipe in particular that you might recommend?
There's a recipe for Thai basil pork in the book that calls for a combination of fish sauce, oyster sauce, and soy sauce, but you can very easily omit the soy sauce in that recipe because it has so many of those other umami ingredients. There's also a recipe for these Vietnamese American garlic noodles that have a combination of Parmesan, fish sauce, and oyster sauce in them. That sounds like a very strange combination, but it's one of my favorite recipes in the book. And there's so much, there's so much flavor going on there. You definitely don't miss the little dash of soy sauce if you have to leave it out.
Okay, we've got about 20 seconds left. Quick speed round. Spicy or sweet? What do you prefer?
Spicy.
Kosher or sea salt?
Kosher salt. Well, the two are not exclusive, but I use kosher salt to season with.
Team chicken or team fish?
I would like to say fish, but probably in reality chicken.
And favorite recipe when you're feeling down?
Mapo tofu.
All right, that is J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, food writer and author of the new book, The Wok, which is available now. Kenji, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, tortellini and how to make it. Chef Joe Gatto gives us a crash course in making pasta in Studio 2. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we are munching on some of our favorite food segments from the past year. J. Kenji Lopez-Alt showed us the miracle that is a wok, at least when he's cooking with it. And now, Chef Joe Gatto, the creator of the Pluto TV show From Scratch, has made us everything from ice cream to apple crisp. Finally, we said, Joe, how about you teach us how to do it? And he accepted the challenge. And first up, pasta. WBUR reporter Walter Wuthman joined us as honorary taster in Studio 2 just before Thanksgiving, and Chef Joe brought in his ingredients and a lot of enthusiasm. As we started, I asked him, Joe, why pasta?
Pasta to me is just the quintessential family food, right? When you think pasta, you think everybody's sitting down at a table. There's a big bowl of it in the middle. Everyone's digging in, right? Grandma's sauce. That's the kind of stuff I love about food, how it brings everyone together. And I just love making pasta. It's one of the first things I did with my kids. They are now, I would say, experts at it. I mean, they can run my classes. They're just so good at it. It was funny, a funny little story. I came home this about 2-3 weeks ago, and my son was teaching his friends how to make pasta.
On his own?
How on old, his own.
How
He's 12.
Old is Benjamin? Okay, that's impressive. So, Walt, any pasta traditions in your house?
I think we just eat it out of the box, which is sad. I did try to make pasta once during the pandemic when we were all chefs suddenly, and it didn't go great. I'm excited to try yours.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the thing I love about pasta is, we teach it everywhere, and I'm constantly, this is one of my most popular things to teach because everyone does want to learn it. And it's really not that complicated. It's something you can do at home. Really easy, and especially with the kids.
So I'm surprised to hear that because you've selected tortellini for us to make here in the studio today. Yes, we are making tortellini in the studio today. And that's got like stuff in it and layers and did I mention stuff? Right? And so it actually seems like something that would be pretty complicated to make.
It does. From the outside, it does. Everyone thinks it's going to be, like flour. It's going to be like a, I Love Lucy skit, right? There's just going to be flour everywhere and things are going to catch fire. But it's really, really simple. And I've made some for us to taste earlier today.
Heck yeah.
And I made us the pasta sheets. And also on my Instagram at Chef Joe Gatto, I actually did this demo last night. So if anyone wants to check it out, they can go there
can
and check it out.
They can watch that there too. Excellent. Excellent.
So you can see here, this is the pasta sheet.
All right,
right?
So we've got a sheet, a rectangle sheet of floury pasta. It's, I don't know, it's probably about 8 to 10 inches long and what, 3 inches wide?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
All right.
Yeah, and this is, of course, very, very simple. Mm-hmm. It's eggs and flour.
Okay.
Okay, and I use a food processor because it's super fast.
Yeah.
I know how to do it, you know, the old-fashioned way. But you put eggs in the flour, you spin it, and it whirs. And you have pasta dough.
Okay, so what if you don't have a spinny thing that whirs?
You've got your hands.
Can you mix this by... Well, when you tried it during the pandemic, did you have fancy equipment or did you do it by
my hands. Yeah. My hands on the
counter. Best tool in the kitchen, right?
Yeah.
Is your hands.
And it'll work. It'll blend.
Oh, yeah. You just start. What you do is actually you make a little volcano and you put the eggs in the center.
Yeah.
And then you're whipping with a fork, which slowly incorporates the flour. And then you take it and you have your dough. And then you just need to roll it out to develop that gluten so it has a little strength. Because, you know, we're going to roll this thin. We're going to stuff it and put it in boiling water. So we want it to have a little strength, you know?
That's so interesting. So so I am half Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And as a kid,
my
Nona had an apartment in our house. And there were so many kids that I actually lived in her apartment with her for a number of years. And she taught me how to make gnocchi. That was the big family pasta. And it was the opposite of everything on that, right? It has to be super, you don't want it to be too tense. You don't want too much flour. You have to be, and so for a lot of people, I think most pastas are intimidating that way. I won't get it right. It'll taste awful. Why don't I just go to Walt's Point and get it from the box?
Right, and that's part of the whole reason I love to teach, is to kind of demystify just how hard things are, because most things are really simple. We just made gnocchi, like, last week. We made them into little pumpkins.
Yeah, no, those were gorgeous. I saw a picture of those. They were actually pumpkin gnocchi, folks, and they looked like little pumpkins in a bowl.
With a little rosemary.
I was pretty
stem.
Jealous. Yeah. I could not do that.
Were they pumpkin spiced?
Yeah, they were pumpkin flavored. It was ridiculous.
As they said, it sounds good.
My daughter ate it, and she just turned to me, and she went, come on. So I was like, yes.
All right, so teach us with this strip of pasta that you've made that we have on our clean Studio 2 table here. Teach us how to turn this into tortellini.
So what we're going to do is, here's our ricotta filling.
Okay.
Right?
Oop, what's in that roughly?
Down. This is ricotta, some dried herbs like rosemary, thyme. It has a little red pepper flake because I like a little spice.
Okay.
Some fresh garlic and lemon juice. Ricotta, also easy to make at home. Mm-hmm. I didn't make this one, though.
But you are known for making things truly, say it with me,
from scratch. So I have that, and I have just a little bit of water.
Okay.
And the water is really just a glue.
Okay.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this biscuit cutter. You don't have a biscuit cutter? Juice glass, wine glass. I'm sure everyone has a wine glass.
Anything that's round.
Exactly.
All right.
And it doesn't even have to be round. If you just want to cut it square with a knife, this is so adaptable. That's what I love about it. Once you understand this recipe and how simple it is, it's super malleable.
Okay.
So I'm going to place that on there. I'm going to push down, and I'm going to give it a little twist.
And it cuts right out.
Right?
Yeah.
So now I have a happy little circle.
Yeah.
So what I want to do is I want to take some of this filling, mm-hmm. right? And I put it in the center.
Okay.
Now here's a little hint. Don't go crazy. You're tempted to put a ton in there, right? Because I'm going to have a big, huge ravioli.
Right, right.
You want to keep it. So when we fold it over, it doesn't squirt out the sides.
Okay.
Because once the fat hits the edge, it's impossible to seal.
Okay.
So we take a little water, which now, if we use too much,
this
it will slip
so much
and slide.
Like dumpling making.
It's the exact same thing.
Okay.
It's just...
All right. This is dumpling making with tortellini ingredients.
Dumplings, empanadas, right? Like pierogies. Like everything, every culture seems to have a version.
Okay.
So, and they're just nuanced, the differences. So I do that. Then I'm going to fold this over.
So you've wet all the edges with
yep.
the tip of your finger and a little bit of water, and you're fold. Oh, you almost have too much in
so
there.
So right now it's like
just
a little
to the
taco.
Edge, right?
Right. It looks like a little taco. That's right.
So I go right to the edge. You see how I push the limits there?
and he did.
Right?
I was like, he's got too much feeling.
I'm like Tom Cruise in Days of Thunder, you know? I'm going to rev that engine as far as I can go. And so I make this little shape right here.
I would like to say also that that is a large tortellini.
It is very large.
Yeah.
I'm big or go home, you know.
Yeah,
we'll call it Texas tortellini.
Yeah. Are you a tortellini fan?
I'm in every pasta, every shape.
Then this is definitely going to be.
Every shape,
pasta
every
nivorous.
Filling, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So now I have this happy little guy.
Got a little moon.
Right?
Yeah.
So now I take my fingers, I put it on the sides, I take my thumb,
mm-hmm.
I push to the center, and then I take its little legs, and I tie them together.
Okay, so now it's a wheel. It's a wheel.
So yeah. Okay. Now we have the tortellini, which has the ridge.
Yep.
And pasta has ridges, if you didn't know, to catch sauce.
Yes.
So now we have our tortellini.
Wow. So that really was quite simple.
Right.
How long did it take to turn flour and egg into the dough?
30 seconds.
Okay. And how long did it take to mix the ricotta mix?
30 seconds.
By your own? You're exaggerating. Really?
No. No, you're just dumping stuff in there and mixing it around.
All right. And how long to knead it all out into this perfect, you know, bed of...
I want to say 30 seconds, but it's not.
But
it wasn't.
It's not. Yeah. How long was it?
That took like a minute.
Okay.
So it develops fairly...
So as you get more experience, this really is something you could quickly and realistically do at home.
Oh, I could make pasta before you go to the store, buy pasta, and come back.
Okay. No, yeah, now you're showing up.
Yeah, well, totally. Totally. You can't see me flexing on the radio.
That's right.
So why don't you give it a shot, right?
Okay.
And then we'll just see what happens. We'll see just how easy it is.
Okay, I'm on a headset mic here in the studio. Walt is not, so Walt doesn't get to try this part.
So you really want to...
But I'm going
to
seek a consultation from you, Walt, on how much of the ricotta to put in. Okay, so I've got my circle.
I think you're looking really good.
So, Walt...
You don't want to do too much, you
right.
just said.
How's this?
Let's try a little more.
A little more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
See, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Is there egg in the filling? Out of curiosity.
No, I don't use egg in my filling.
Okay.
I just never liked it.
Okay.
So I am going to run my fingers around the edges just like I was told, right? This feels also a little like doing origami, by the way.
Oh, I dig that. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. And
it's
so
like zen.
Now I'm going to press the edges together. How am I doing, Walt?
I think you're doing very well.
Thank you. That was very kind of you. All right. Oh, look, it is working. I mean, I don't have too much. Oh. I got a little bleed there on the edge. Is it going to be all right?
Walt,
we did a little too much. We were, we were too excited.
That's exactly what happens.
All right, can I poke it back in there?
Yeah, sure you can.
I'm going to try.
It's not going to know any better.
Okay.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah, now I just got some
disaster.
Smash. Yes.
We have a disaster.
We tried, Walt. We tried. All right, so Walt and I can now tell you, swear to God, when he says don't put too much filling in the tortellini.
I'm just saying I've done this a couple times.
Yeah, a couple thousand, right? And now we're going to push the little,
yep.
And then we're going to... So
fold
I've made
like
my wheel. I got tortellini
yep.
spilling, ricotta spilling out everywhere.
It's everywhere.
All right. There it is, though. We
That's
at least
awesome.
Know the basics of it now.
That's exactly.
And I'm
going
to lick my finger.
The one that goes to the basement we don't talk about.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
That's. But you can see yep. it's really not that hard.
No.
Right? All you were was just a little overzealous on the filling.
I was pretty excited
the
about the ricotta. And
That's
so
what
was
happens.
Well. Not going to lie. We were both excited.
And the great thing about when you make pasta, right? You can put anything in it. Leftover roasted vegetables, you blend them up a little bit, pulse them in the food processor, a little ricotta, boom, mm-hmm. you got a filling.
Mm-hmm.
Leftover ground burger, boom, little ricotta, little Parmesan,
yep.
you got a filling. One of my favorites is to use leftover chicken, like roasted chicken, pull it, chop it, and then put a little prosciutto and peas with it,
mm-hmm.
and then pop that in.
That yeah. sounds fantastic.
And you do
yeah.
that with any kind of sauce. And yeah. I mean, you're talking rock star because you can make this into raviolis.
Yep.
You know, fettuccine. You've got the base for everything.
The
exact
same
pasta.
All right. So while you open up, because now you've made us hungry, the part we're going to eat, I will say, you know, my Nona also made ravioli when I was little, and she would have the old school grinder and would get the pork and grind out the pork sausage
oh, yeah.
by hand and put all the seasonings in, a little bit of wine that she made herself. So,
did it go in the food? Or?
Right. So there's lots of, both. So there's lots of from scratch, right, that you
yeah.
can do with
I
these
mean,
ingredients. All right. Now, I want to, we've got about 4 minutes left, so I want to
perfect.
Stay on pace because you have chosen to serve this tortellini in pesto.
Yes.
So
this,
talk about that.
This is my toasted pistachio pesto.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite thing to talk about this pesto is when people are like, they taste it and they're like, what?
Yeah.
This is
what in a good way.
Oh yeah, right. Not like what have you done? I'm joking.
Yeah.
This is literally the dish that I hooked my wife with.
Okay.
This like put her over the top. She was like, "Yeah, that's it."
This is the and guy that,
like,
you marry.
You literally give her the pesto. Cut to 3 kids. You know, like. So these are the ones I made earlier.
They look gorgeous.
With the pistachio pesto, and you get the
vibrant green, you can see the size of the, you know, you can see the tortellini still perfectly shaped because unlike Walt and me, he did not overstuff.
Yeah,
I didn't. I've learned that lesson.
One, it almost looks like a little hat.
It does.
Yes. So he's going to put that in the middle of the plate for us.
Yep. I'm going to do a third one here.
Awesome.
I don't know who's going to, but I've got a little...
You got a little fettuccine from
I got
that
a little
same
fettuccine
pasta
as well.
To go there as well.
So I'm going to put that on the side of the plate. So
okay.
everyone can dip in.
And I'm going to pass this to Walt.
This is pretty much my son's. He goes it back and forth, nutty. But
thank you.
This is pretty much his favorite.
All right, so while Walt takes a bite, because he's our first taste tester, and I'm going to take a bite too, I'm going to ask you, what about people who want to make pesto but have nut allergies in their homes?
You know what? I make a pesto version, and I take out the nuts, and I use avocado.
And that works.
And it works beautiful. It comes out super creamy. It's super healthy.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I'm tasting the tortellini. Keep talking.
Right? And I think it's literally the nuts are just one avocado.
Mm-hmm.
And you add lemon juice in the pesto anyway, so it all the flavors just match. And it's a really easy thing. And I've done it with kale. I've done it with spinach. Like, you can... Once you learn the base of this as well,
you can play.
Right, exactly.
All right, let's get our review, Walt.
It's really good, and it's vegetarian, right?
Correct.
But it's, I don't know, it's got a lot of flavor. It's like really complex.
That's
flavor.
Awesome. That's exactly what I want it to be. I want it to have depth.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And not just
that's the word.
Not just cover up the pasta. This should be its own, you know, and enhance all the flavors. And the pasta should be nice and tender. And that, you know,
yeah,
I
love
that.
It's the right amount of al dente. How long did you boil it for? Because it is the right amount of al dente there.
It was right around 2.5 minutes.
Which with a fresh pasta, you can do it just quite briefly.
Exactly. And you have to heavily salt your water. You know, it should be like ocean water. When we do the next one, I'm going to pull fresh mozz.
So what is the next one?
I want to do pizza. Oh, and I want to pull fresh mozzarella in studio.
Well, it's like, well,
I've seen a lot of people just like out there. Everyone's like, wait, is that next week?
The whole Radio Boston team just got excited, folks. All right, so listen, we have to say goodbye. That's Chef Joe Gatto, culinary instructor, author, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, who is joining the Radio Boston family and bringing From Scratch to us, starting with tortellini today. Joe, you're the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And this was a blast. I can't wait for the next
one. Can't wait for the next one. Walt Withman, thank you for being our intrepid taster today.
Thank you.
And for doing politics with us
today
on the show.
Thank you. Invite me back.
Coming up, are you making a resolution this year? Maybe you're thinking about changing the way you eat. In just a minute, we revisit a conversation with three WBUR reporters who did just that with varying levels of success. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're feasting on some of our favorite food segments from 2022 today. And with the new year just days away, we thought we'd bring you three WBUR reporters who tried a very special resolution. The challenge? Eat sustainably in three categories: vegan, hyperlocal, and zero plastic packaging. Martha Biebinger, WBUR health reporter, took on the plastic. Andrea Shea, WBUR arts reporter, went hyperlocal. And Barbara Moran, WBUR environmental correspondent, went vegan, much to her children's chagrin. They reported their experiences in WBUR's sustainable eating newsletter, Cooked, which you can find on our website at wbur.org/cooked. And when they joined us back in May to tell us about it, I started by asking for the origin story of this idea, which I had heard had something to do with vegan cheese.
Yeah. So that happened a little bit before the vegan cheese when I was reporting on the last big UN climate report. And I was feeling very overwhelmed by the climate crisis and wondering what I could do. And a lot of people say, you know, eating vegan is the best thing you can do, right? So I'm in the grocery store and I'm looking at this packet of like vegan cheese, and it's made with all this stuff. I don't even know. Was it like coconut oil and all this? And it's in a plastic bag and it's hyper processed. And I'm like, really?
This is the best way.
Is this really good for the planet? Like, what about this nice little ball of mozzarella from the farm? This seems better than this. And like, I didn't know, right? And I had all these like questions. Is this really better? And so I'm like, well, let's find out.
So what's interesting is, so you worked with some grad students from Tufts. Yeah. They did a little research for you to go into the newsletter, and they looked at things like, you know, which sweetener has the lowest environmental impact. And it was interesting. One of your big takeaways was that there's a lot we don't know. The existing research is actually pretty incomplete on the environmental impact of how we eat.
Yeah, there's a ton of research that's been done on sort of greenhouse gas emissions and water use for various farm products. But that's where the bulk of it is. And that's the bulk of environmental impacts from agriculture. But, you know, there's a ton of other environmental impacts, you know, on like biodiversity and carbon sequestration in the soil and, you know, everything else. And it just doesn't exist yet. One of my guys I interviewed said it's like the early days of like Galileo looking at the planets. Like that's how he feels like where the research is now.
So there's a lot of work to do. Martha, yeah. I'll turn to you for a second. You're a health reporter. Why did you want in on this? Especially you signed up for something that seems kind of torturous, which is to try to shop with zero plastic. Why sign up for this?
Well, there's a growing body of evidence about the impact of plastic on health. And I won't dive into that now because it would take over the conversation. But you might have seen that research out of, I think it was Australia a little while back, that said the upshot is we consume about a credit card's worth of plastic a week.
You mean into our bodies?
Yeah.
I eat a credit card a week.
Water. A lot of that comes in through, not necessarily Massachusetts water, but water in parts of the world. But in any case, I thought, you know, I don't want to be ingesting a ton of plastic. So I'm going to see if I can just live without it for a week. And that, yeah, it was partly health and it was partly just sort of trying to understand, trying to get a little bit more aware of what I was buying and how I was taking it in.
And Andrea, how about you? You're an arts reporter. You already were eating fairly healthy, fairly local. This was next level local. Why'd you do it?
Well, I mean, I love cooking. I think about food probably too much. And I care about
he
what
thinks
I...
He about it all the time.
True.
Me too.
And, you know, I mean, I care about what I eat. I care about what I put in my body. I care about what I feed my kids, which is can be another matter. But I thought it would be fun... initially, kind of like pushing myself into this kind of lived experiment with my body and what I put into it. And I thought it would force me to be creative. I thought, of course, that it would challenge my assumptions, which it did. But it also just kind of floored me for a week of you know, I think about food a lot, but in this case, I was thinking about it from the moment I woke up until the moment I went to bed.
So, Andrea and Martha, your endeavors were for a week and you had a budget limit. Is that correct from both of you, Andrea?
Oh, yeah.
And Martha, you too,
right? That was
right?
The assignment, yes.
Okay. Now, Barbara, you were a month back in January. Was yeah. there a, so you had a time period that was longer. Did you have a budget threshold too?
No, I think I snuck in before there was a budget. So, yeah, I was just lucky winging you. It, okay. Throwing money around.
All right. And now, on the count of three, I'm going to have you guys all answer the next question at the same time. Mm. So, wait. The question is, did you succeed? One, two, three.
Yes,
yeah.
I know.
So this is where we want to dive in next. And Barbara, I'll come back to you. And I'm actually going to bring your kids right into this.
Uh-oh.
From the beginning, Barbara. One of the things that we hear in your reporting that we loved was Finn, 14, your son, reacting to some of the stuff that you brought home during this month that you tried to eat vegan, which you were not before. You weren't even vegetarian. We're talking nutritional yeast, vegan chorizo. And here he is asking you, honestly, why?
Why? What are you talking
it's
about?
It's just better we? For you. Us. The planet.
You think that's better for the planet?
I don't know. That's the question, right?
It's probably not.
And did he like it?
Did he like it? No. Oh, no, no. And I was talking to him about this yesterday. He has not changed his tune at all. No. He's still not into the vegan thing. He's very into meat. So that was the big question I was trying to answer, you know, at the beginning, like, is like soy chorizo and vegan cheese actually better? And it is not so blow everything in the newsletter, but it is actually better. It has lower greenhouse gas emissions and lower water use and all those things. But, you know, doesn't necessarily mean it worked in my house.
And what was the hardest part in that month eating vegan for you? And I understand, you know, you'd been gluten-free prior because you were diagnosed 15 years ago with celiac disease. So you were used to a slightly more limited diet that you started at a time when it was not well known or well accommodated.
Yeah.
So even with that in mind, what was the hardest part?
Yeah. Well, like Andrea, I thought the good part was that it did make me sort of reassess how I eat and sort of shake it up. Like, I, you know, I'm a like a working mom and we have like seven meals that we circulate through, right? But like the hardest part was the kids, right? Like finding stuff that they would want to eat and just getting them to eat and dealing with their complaining.
Yeah, I wouldn't have either. I did not even attempt to pull my 18-year-old son into
You just
this.
Did it yourself.
Yeah.
So, Andrea, you and Martha, just for listeners, Andrea's here in the studio. Martha's on the line. The two of you had some real grocery shopping challenges as well, whereas Barbara, there was a little more room to breathe there. So talk about how hard it was to shop, Martha.
Well, I walked into the grocery store thinking like, I know what plastic looks like. I know what food it's on. And I was completely wrong. I spent a ton of time, I remember, in the oil aisle, tapping on lids to figure out if they were plastic or metal, putting them in my cart, and then 15 minutes later realizing, oh, the label is plastic. Oh. I gotta go put that back. So I walked in circles in the grocery store, picking things up and putting them back. And then when I got to the checkout line, I was loading my stuff onto the cart and I saw all these little plastic stickers on the pepper or on the onion or them like, and they had put a plastic sticker on the meat because of course you can't buy any meat that isn't already in plastic. So I went to the counter and got it, but they put a plastic sticker with the poundage and the price. And, you know, so it was just like, it felt like a lesson in futility.
It honestly. Sounds demoralizing, Martha.
Well, at the end, I just bought that pepper because I was too pissed off. I was like, I'm going to have to chalk this up. I ended up with a violation list. That's why I answered no to your question. I ended up with a violation.
You had a violation list. And Andrea, did you have a violation list too? And you have to pull in this Marco Polo exception in your answer because this is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually oddly kind of encouraged to have cheats, not encouraged.
And I'm sorry, I should remind listeners, you were hyper-local.
Yeah, so why don't I'll define what hardcore locavore, which I am not. But basically, locavores, which are people that really focus on eating sustainably and locally, they generally are eating between 150 mile and 100 and 150 miles from their home, so mm-hmm. a radius of that distance. And so my editors gave me 200 miles. The USDA often uses for various things regarding agriculture to define it as local, they use 400 miles. So a 200-mile radius, which sounded like a gift at first, is really tricky. I basically, to speak to Martha, going into the grocery store when I went to Stop and Shop as my first place to attempt to find things I'd be able to eat for the week, I just GPSed everything. And then when I walked in there in the produce aisle, there was a shelf, not very large, that said, buy local. Mm. And I went over there, but it was all food that was made locally. So condiments and salsa and even roasted coffee, which of course coffee is, we have many, countless, frankly, it seems, local coffee roasters, but none of the beans are local.
Yeah, I'd be done.
Yeah.
Well, that's the exception. Yeah, you can. Yeah,
right. So you getting to the exception. So, I mean, I was able, I kind of went into this without doing too much pre-research, thinking that it would be more interesting and perhaps more authentic to kind of have this lived experience as it was happening organically.
Yeah.
So I really was learning on the fly. And coffee was the first thing that I knew I wasn't going to be able to have, which I did not anticipate I've gone through coffee withdrawal before, but not realizing when you want to be sharp and you want to be on it. So I was kind of falling apart a little bit there. Yeah. So feeling a little scattered, feeling like, what have I done to myself?
So what was the exception? What did you give yourself?
So about, I think it was day
Martha
four.
Martha took the pepper. Yeah. What was yours?
Well, day four, day five, Barbara let me in on something that's called the Marco Polo exception.
Yeah.
Which locavores use because olive oil. Not being able to use olive oil or oil. I'm not a big butter fan. I ended up finding butternut squash seed oil from a local farm, which I ended up loving. Nutty, $15 a bottle, I think, yeah. for maybe 8 ounces.
Yeah, that's
so,
a lot.
So the pantry
that
items.
Your budget.
Oh, yeah, the pantry items. I mean, salt, things like that. So those would be exceptions that you could work into this Marco Polo existence,
yeah.
including perhaps beer.
Perhaps beer. Well, actually, we're going to talk about some local brews after the break, so that will be an interesting opportunity to explore that. Martha, I'm going to come back to you for a second. Just briefly, I'm going to play a little sound from a person you talked to at a zero-waste location that you found a shop at. And there were even things you couldn't get there that were plastic-free. So here's Greg Sednoy, general manager at Pemberton Farms in Cambridge, giving a bit of a look at why that is.
There was so much forward momentum in zero waste, especially in the Boston area before COVID. But customers wanted peace of mind. They didn't want a broken seal. They didn't want anything that had already been touched by anybody else. And I think we've just gone in reverse in a lot of ways.
As a health reporter, how did that resonate with you, Martha?
That was super discouraging because I think, you know, not only were we already moving in the direction of plastic used in food packaging increasing, but now we've instituted some habits during COVID that I think are going to be even tougher for some of us to break. So if you want to try to shop plastic-free, it's just going to become, it is becoming, it already has become, and may become even more difficult.
So Barb, on that note, I turn back to you. Some discouraging stories here, and yet, as you're working on Cooked, you're finding there are little things we can do. So what are a couple of things that aren't as overwhelming as what the three of you tried that people can yes. actually do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there such little things can make a huge difference. Just swapping out, like, beef for chicken one meal a week actually makes a huge difference, you know? Paying attention to where your vegetables are coming from. Talking, I think the thing that makes the biggest difference is asking your grocery store or restaurant where their food comes from, because they really pay attention to consumers. So I think people have a lot more power than they think. And I think that's why the best part of the newsletter is I want it to be really empowering to people who are concerned about climate change and want to make a difference.
Andrea, briefly, biggest change you've made that'll be permanent?
Biggest change that'll be permanent. Well, I mean, stepping foot in a grocery store will never be the same again.
There you go.
It's overwhelming. And it really, to be surrounded by bottles and boxes and cans of foods that are coming from all over the place. And it really speaks to how susceptible our food supply mm-hmm. chain yeah. system is. And if it went down for real, it would just be devastating. Mm-hmm. So knowing, you know, part of the reason to support local farms and to support local things that are closer to you is creating a more resilient food system for everyone. And it creates community. And just knowing the people that are handling your food, that's and the care that they put into it, that's one of my biggest takeaways.
That's fantastic. Martha, how about you? Quickly, just one permanent change for you.
I'm going to make a lot more of my own stuff. Hummus, for example. Yeah. I'm really struggling on the yogurt. If anybody has tips, let me know.
Plastic-free yogurt?
Yeah.
Got it. All right, you heard it, folks. Let's help Martha out with that one. We're all on Twitter. You can help us there. Barbara, how do we get the newsletter? How do people sign up?
WBUR.org/cooked.
Thanks to WBUR reporters Martha Biebinger, Andrea Shea, and Barbara Moran. And that newsletter, Earl, is correct. If you want to understand how to reduce your impact on climate change with your food choices and take actionable steps so you can make a difference, sign up for Cooked. Again, that's WBUR.org/cooked. And that's our special holiday week show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladune is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for an hour-long show about the tea. A panel of experts will break down the last year on the trains and talk about what needs to happen to get us back on track in 2023.